Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Congress comes to town in the wake of the murder of Irina Zarudzka, and they get an earful.
This cashless bail system is a joke.
The state auditor releases an unflattering report on cat security. The mayor pushes back. A busy week for Governor Josh Stein. He endorses our transit plan, pounds the General Assembly on Medicaid funding, and calls any attempts at further redistricting ridiculous. And we look back on this. We'll leave you guessing on that one. Stay with us. Here to talk about those stories and more is WSOC-TV reporter Joe Bruno. He's here along with David Hodges, an investigative reporter with WBTV. Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte, and we'll be joined later on by Julian Berger. Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter here at WFAE. Let's begin with some breaking news, Joe, because yesterday a letter was written and I guess released late yesterday or early this morning by the Fraternal Order of Police notifying the city that they are intending to request federal law enforcement assistance, including the National Guard in Charlotte. What's this all about?
Yeah, so basically the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Fraternal Order of Police is requesting the National Guard in Charlotte. They point out that there have been 15 homicides since the homicide of Irina Zarudzka. They say that the current staffing levels in CMPD have created a crisis and federal assistance is now needed in order to ensure safety.
And they write, despite statistical progress, because city leaders constantly cite the decrease in crime and the decrease in the murder rate, violence, they say, violent crime continues to be a daily reality in Charlotte. And they respond, they talk about staff shortages, which are an organizational stressor. And they're urging the mayor and city council and city leaders to get behind this request. Is that likely to happen?
I would not be surprised to see some members of our delegation, some members of city council, maybe like one or two, or people running for city council to sign off on this and back the FOP in this request. I think the mayor and city manager, when they have a press conference in the next 2 hours, I would be surprised if they formally back this request as well, but they're going to certainly have to answer questions about it. It is significant that the FOP is requesting this as the voice of so many CMPD officers. But, you know, the letter came out at 6 a.m. today. It's been 3 hours since then, and there's a lot of people who are either waking up to this or figuring out how to respond to it now.
The FOP claims to be the voice of 1,690 CMPD officers who are members of their organization. When he talks about in this letter your safety press conference tomorrow being too late, is he referring to the mayor's press conference 2 hours from now?
Correct. Yeah. This letter was formally sent to city leaders yesterday. So that he's talking about the press conference that's happening at 11.
And he says it's too late because too many lives, this is a quote, too many lives have already been lost while waiting for action. Why has it taken so long to address safety concerns when we have been raising alarms for years? It has been proven that a strong police presence deters crime by eliminating or reducing opportunities, something only the federal government can quickly remedy. This is likely to be perceived on the part of the Trump administration as an invitation, correct?
I have reached out to the Trump administration, and the Trump administration has previously said, the vice president previously said that, you know, if local leaders request the National Guard, we will fulfill their request. This is not the only voice in Charlotte, so it will be interesting to see how this letter is received.
David.
I think what will be really interesting, too, about this is exactly how delicate the dance is around this from Charlotte leaders. We're going to bring this up shortly, but recently a bunch of members of Congress came to Charlotte and had a lot of critical things to say about crime overall. Didn't criticize Charlotte that much, and almost none of those Republican Congress members said anything about bringing the National Guard to Charlotte. So there seems to be some type of decent relationship, even though Charlotte is a mostly blue city and Republicans in Washington, D.C. So it'll be really interesting to see how this works out.
And several of the Congress members on that subcommittee that came to town are from North Carolina, as some of them represent this part of North Carolina. Would the Fraternal Order of Police be considered a city leader?
I think that they are influential enough that they would, that their letter would carry a lot of weight.
Okay. So we'll keep our eye on this as it develops. The mayor has a press conference in 2 hours. I'm sure that she will address this. The subcommittee that David Hodges just referred to, the congressional subcommittee, was in Charlotte on Monday. It was obviously a Republican-led subcommittee because the Republicans control Congress. What did they hope to learn? What did they learn? And what will they do with the information that they learned?
The point of having hearings like this typically is to gather testimony and incorporate that testimony into future legislation. I think the most powerful moments of the press conference were when we were hearing from victims of violent crime, the family members of the victims of violent crime. Stephen Federico talked about his daughter, Logan Federico, who was a waitress in Charlotte and died in Columbia, South Carolina. We heard from Mia Alderman about her granddaughter, Mary Collins, who was stabbed to death in NOTA. They just shared some incredibly heartbreaking stories. And unfortunately, the deaths in these cases were involving people who were arrested many, many times in some cases, and in others, they're still waiting for justice, even though it's been a long time since the homicides occurred.
So prior to that meeting, about 80 protesters gathered outside the federal building where they were holding that meeting. The Observer reported that progressive and religious groups organized the protest over the hearing, which protesters described as politically motivated, adding that real solutions would focus more on mental health and funding the criminal justice system, which is something that the FOP is calling for here this morning. That was before the hearing began. David, did they address those concerns in that hearing?
I mean, you mostly heard the two Democrats who were sitting there on the subcommittee, Representative Adams and Ross, bring up mental health issues. The references that mostly came from it in terms of Republicans was saying that to categorize this as just a mental health issue is selling the situation short. I think the reality is that it's probably a combination of all the things. So mental health did come up, but just very vaguely, I would say. And it didn't really impact the mental health equation. Was not really related to the situation of the witnesses who were there. So while the name that you heard the Congress members say most was Irina Zarutska in that situation, her family was invited to participate. They declined to participate. So it was a real mismatch of different issues, different problems, including South Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, and trying to simplify it into one simple solution, and it just doesn't really work that way.
Democratic Congresswoman Alma Adams spoke prior to the hearing to the crowd gathered outside, telling them that her Republican colleagues were in town simply to score political points.
And so make no mistake about it, they're only doing this. They're only in Charlotte today because they want to win a Senate seat next year. And that is the real truth. And so the reality of putting politics over people seems to be the only way my Republican colleagues know how to govern anymore.
She, too, brought up the need to address crime holistically by hiring more prosecutors, public defenders, and others to address the backlog of cases that are piling up in our courts. Anything less, she said, quote, is disrespecting Irina's memory. And later inside the hearing, as you referred to, David, committee member Democratic Representative Deborah Ross responded to her Republican colleagues' calls for stricter bond conditions and tougher enforcement by asking some questions of her own.
Why is the Congress cutting aid to local law enforcement by $100 million next year? Why are they proposing cuts to the Crime Victims Fund? Why do they want to slash juvenile justice grants and hate crime grants?
All valid questions. These hearings are the opportunities for members to make political points. That's true. But did any of her Republican colleagues, Alex, respond? Give her answers to any of those questions, or was that just rhetorical?
I think that an overwhelming message from this, from the Republican leaders, was that money is not the solution here in their eyes. They came in and it seemed like they were all very set on promoting cashless, getting rid of cashless bail. That's a really big talking point for them. And it happens to be one of the issues that's on Governor Stein's desk right now that they're pushing for him to sign. So I thought that was interesting because something that we've talked about a lot in Mecklenburg County when it comes to some of these cases is just the lack of staffing in the courthouse and prosecutors. And they were basically saying that's not the answer. This is more of a policy issue.
Perhaps this FOP letter this morning asking for the National Guard to be sent to Charlotte to quell some of the crime that we've been experiencing should not surprise us, because evidently there's been an undercurrent of dissatisfaction on the police force, on CMPD. And among those who testified at this hearing was CMPD Officer Justin Campbell, who was injured last year when CMPD and federal agents were attempting to serve a warrant and were fired on by a suspect who ended up killing four officers.
The judicial system here in Mecklenburg County, I can speak firsthand, is trash. And I'll say it again over and over again. And I'll take the repercussions, what comes next after me saying that. But the magistrate system here has no idea what they are doing. This cashless bail system is a joke.
He told the committee that he feels, quote, the majority of the work I've done as a police officer was pointless because they'll be out on the streets while I'm still writing out the report. And we've heard this before from other sources, other officers. Cashless bail has come under heavy criticism in the wake of this Irina Zarutska incident. But how does it apply to the alleged murderer in this case, DeCarlos Brown?
It is a complicated, complicated answer. First and foremost, I've done a ton of reporting on magistrates and the system. He is not completely wrong. It is definitely lacking a lot of qualifications and a lot of oversight. But in this particular situation, where DeCarlos Brown Jr. was arrested in January for misuse of the 911 system, there's almost no county in North Carolina where he would have been held on a secured bond for a misdemeanor of that low magnitude until this murder took place in August. So trying to just say that cashless bail directly relates to that situation is way oversimplifying the situation. And even under the new Irena's law that's proposed that would get rid of totally cashless bail or written promises to appear, it still would allow unsecured bonds, which my sources and defense attorneys tell me essentially you get out for free. And if you don't show up for court, you're then supposed to pay whatever that bond was. But the reality of the situation is that money is almost never gone after. So yeah. Are you getting rid of cashless bail? Maybe, kind of, with this. Again, the talking points are way more complicated than is allowed for in this committee hearing.
Former North Carolina House Speaker Tim Moore, now a Republican U.S. member of the House on that committee, held a press conference at which, David, you asked him a question about why he didn't do more to tackle some of the problems facing Mecklenburg's judicial system while he was in the General Assembly.
I was wondering if I could ask you why you didn't pursue cashless bail reform or magistrate reform when you were one of the most powerful politicians in the state.
We actually passed legislation to deal with that. We also, to make it more difficult for courts to put in place cashless bail.
I have 40 seconds. Is that true? Did they do those things?
They did pass the Pretrial Release Act, which allowed for essentially more uniformity in certain violent offenses and bail for those situations. But the issues that my sources are telling me about, it's all about magistrates and local control. You have judicial officials who really just need a high school degree and a little bit of teaching, a couple hours of courses, and they can sign warrants, set bail, all kinds of things. The system needs reform, according to the sources I'm talking to.
There's a lot of finger pointing to go around. We'll talk about that with regard to this House subcommittee coming to town. And then we'll talk about cats and security on cats, because that was a big topic this week as well. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and
the next
Habitat
Charlotte, Talks,
Charlotte
the
Region.
For
since
life
1983,
in the universe,
Habitat
mankind
Charlotte Region
has, been
has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, home ownership, and critical home repair. More information at HabitatCharlotteRegion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here this morning with Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Joe Bruno reports for WSOC-TV Channel 9. And David Hodges is here from WBTV. As long as we're talking about this subcommittee that came to town this week to hold hearings in the aftermath of the Irina Zarutska murder on the Blue Line, the chair of that judiciary subcommittee, New Jersey Republican Jeff Van Drew, wrote on X that the hearing would expose, quote, Democrats' soft-on-crime policies, and that, quote, bad leaders let this happen, weak leaders, end quote. And you report, David, that during the hearing, congressional Republicans repeatedly raised concerns about our state's magistrates, something we were just talking about moments ago. They are responsible for setting bonds, issuing warrants, and more. And a year ago, WBTV reported that magistrates in this state have few qualifications, little oversight, and more power than magistrates elsewhere. Now, the state just took some steps to address that in the recent Irina's Law bill that they passed. We'll talk about that later. But wasn't their power, the magistrates' power, the actions they take, the guidelines that they follow, set out by the GOP-controlled legislature?
To some extent. So you have that Pretrial Release Act that I just mentioned, which sets more uniformity for setting bail for violent offenses and things of that nature. But then you have a local policy for each judicial district that talks about bail and what should or should not be set in certain situations. A lot of the defense attorneys I'm talking to say that that is taken as gospel instead of more of a guideline. So there's not as much wiggle room for thinking, is this a risky situation, even though this policy tells me I should set the bond this low? And again, you're asking people who, then there are some very qualified, talented magistrates, but as a whole, the qualifications for that position is so low. And it is a position in which people can just go to them out of the blue, say, I got punched in the face by some random person, and they're signing arrest warrants to go out and bring people into jail and start criminal cases. And there, in Irina's Law, there's very, very little done to address that situation overall.
Who testified about the murder of his daughter said that her killer had 25 felonies on his record and would have been in jail for over 140 years for all the crimes that he had committed. That's an opinion. I don't think that is necessarily a fact. But did he elaborate on the nature of those 25 felonies? Are sentences up to the discretion of judges and magistrates, or are the guidelines also spelled out in the law? Joe.
Yes, he did. He went into some of the charges and he went through the maximum penalties for those charges. And you're going to have to forgive me. I don't want to misspeak on what exactly they were, but he did go over exactly what the maximum sentence could have been for some of them and how plea deals or sentencing allowed him to take a reduced sentence.
And I think the challenge of this committee hearing was that in his situation is horrible, and his grief and the grief of the Zarutska family is, it's just awful what they're going through. His daughter was murdered in Columbia, South Carolina. So a lot of what he was discussing and talking about had to do with the solicitor down there in a committee hearing in which we were largely talking about or hearing the Congress members talk about policies in Charlotte and North Carolina. So it became really difficult to figure out exactly what the through line and connection is of all these situations.
Report that a crime data analyst at the hearing pointed to a national decline in violence, with North Carolina being one of the 44 states to report a drop in the murder rate in 2024. Data from the FBI shows murders in Charlotte are down nearly 30% year to date. And you say those statistics were discounted by Republican committee members as being, quote, rosy. Why do they take issue with the federal government statistics?
There were some concerns that maybe the police departments could manipulate numbers or that they didn't include drug overdoses or homicides by drug overdoses. So they were poking a lot of holes in the data. I think at the end of the day, I can see the argument where in a case like Federico, that was a person who It's not that person was arrested multiple times, had multiple felonies. The rate of violence doesn't really depend in that case. That's more of you're looking at the court system issues. You're not, it doesn't really, it's not very relevant what the crime data is in that case. So I think that they were kind of trying to overshadow that and you know, bring it back to the point of we have to still make sure that this is a safe place for our daughters, as Mary Collins' grandmother put it.
Joe.
And, you know, victims of violent crime don't want to hear that crime is down 0.1% year to year. Like, that does nothing for them. So I think a lot of this was like them saying, like, are we supposed to take comfort that this crime's down 2.5%? And, you know, a lot of times these crime stats, they don't take into effect like the lingering impacts of some of these crimes. And, you know, local leaders keep talking about the third quarter or the second quarter crime stats that were presented in Charlotte that showed a slight minuscule dip, but it doesn't factor in the fact that we had like six people shot in a mass shooting in Uptown, or, you know, a shooting in parking deck of Target. All of that stuff is just one line on a stat sheet in your data. But, you know, this is having a real impact on people who are worried about these high profile and prominent areas that are being impacted by crime.
And that came up when some of the victims of crime or family members of the victims of crimes had a chance to speak to the committee, because if it affects you personally, the statistics, true or not, mean nothing to you. Mia Alderman is the grandmother of Mary Collins, who's been referred to in this conversation already. She was killed in 2020. She was bludgeoned and stabbed more than 130 times in NoDa. Three people have been charged for that crime, but 5 years later, there has yet to be a trial.
5 years is not justice. 5 years is torment.
Is that delay because of just how long it takes to get a case to go to trial, or is it due to backlogs in the courts?
It is a bit of all of the above. And I think she brings up a point, actually, that may be one of the main factors in the feels-like factor of crime across Mecklenburg County. If you look at the amount of pending cases in Mecklenburg County since COVID, it is skyrocketed. And that's something that affects both the families of victims who feel like justice takes forever or might not ever come. Criminal cases are harder to prosecute the more years that go on, trying to find witnesses, police to remember their statements. And then also for the defendants, I mean, if you feel that a case essentially will never come to fruition, the chances of it getting continued again and again and again continue, and the witnesses might back out or move, it might feel like there's no consequences whatsoever.
So Republican Representative Mark Harris from North Carolina says he will introduce two bills in Congress next week, the, quote, No Funding for Lawless Jurisdiction Act and the Cashless Bail Reporting Act. What do those bills propose?
The No Funding for Lawless Jurisdiction Act, that would make sure that jurisdictions would not get federal grants if the cities had defunded their police department or if they had cashless bail. And the Cashless Bail Reporting Act would make it so that cities had to, or the Department of Justice had to identify cities that have cashless bail policies with the goal to just be transparent about, as Mark Harris put it, which cities are releasing dangerous criminals back onto the streets. That's a quote.
So given the two bills that Harris intends to introduce, especially the act that would strip federal grants for public safety from cities that defund their police departments or implement cashless bail, let's refer back to one of the questions that Harris's colleague on that committee, Deborah Ross, asked.
Why is the Congress cutting aid to local law enforcement by $100 million next year?
So, Joe, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe that Charlotte Mecklenburg has defunded the police, but the federal government intends to cut funds for law enforcement, which goes to cities next year. So how do you explain this?
No, the city has never defunded police, even going back to during the George Floyd protests when there was a movement to defund the police. The city increased the police budget by a slight amount. You know, what frustrates me about all of this, Mike, is I hear these heartbreaking stories from these families and they just tear at you. And it's absolutely ridiculous what's happened to them. And it's just everything's become so predictable. There isn't a single person who hears Stephen Federico tell the story about Alexander Dickey being arrested 40 times. Who can reasonably say that this man should have been given a 41st chance? Or DeCarlos Brown being given a 14th or 15th chance? But it just feels like, you know, everything's so predictable. We know what Republicans are going to say. We know what Democrats are going to say, and nothing's going to get done. And even today with the National Guard request, we know that Mayor Lyles, what she's going to say. And we just are stuck in this awful holding pattern where these horrible things keep happening. And we let horrible people do horrible things, and nothing ever changes. And I don't know what we do as a society to change something like that. But it is absolutely ridiculous and heartbreaking hearing these poor families caught in the middle of political football.
Wow, I've never heard you be quite that emotional. No, it's okay.
Joe is completely right. And I mean, the reality is that both Democrat policies and Republican policies are to blame in some aspect of all of these situations. You know, whether it's mental health funding or low bail or low bond, you have Republicans in control in Raleigh and Democrats in control in Charlotte. I mean, it is a combination of all factors. And to Joe's point about how something gets done, it's likely realizing that everybody did something wrong instead of just saying the other side did something wrong, which we see so little in politics today.
Right.
There is a crisis in leadership right now at all levels, local through federal. And it's absolutely sickening that we have to that what's happened to these families. And I pray that something gets done. It was a good step by the state legislature to get some bipartisan legislation to Governor Josh Stein's desk, but more needs to be done.
So the subcommittee from Congress was here in the wake of the murder on the Blue Line. And Dave Bullock, who is North Carolina state auditor, promised to launch an investigation into CATS security protocols as a result of all of this. He has released that report. What does it indicate? Who wants to take that?
The Alex? Two big findings, okay, basically. Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Sorry.
I'll be quick. I won't go on a rant for this one. The two big findings were that from 2022 to now, the security contract increased significantly in value, like 5.9 to 18.4, I believe. But the number of armed security decreased during that time from 68 to 88 armed security officers to about, I think it was 33 or something.
Let me dig into those figures a bit, because this is really eye-opening. His report shows that in 2018, the private security company that CATS contracts with to provide security provided 108 security personnel. Between 68 and 88 of those people were armed. By 2025, that number of armed personnel was down to 39. At the same time, in the same time period, CATS replaced the company who provided armed security with another company, but the audit shows it too was short-staffed. And here's where it really gets interesting, the money situation that you brought up. The report found that between 22 and 25, CATS went from paying $5.9 million for security to $18.4 million in taxpayer money, as the number of the officers they were paying for dropped significantly. And WSOC-TV's Hunter Sines spoke with Dave Bullock to ask where the money went.
Where was this money going if not for armed guards?
Apparently it was going for armed guard services. We're working on answering that question of why. And it clearly was a policy shift. There's no other way to describe such a drastic change.
Has anyone at CATS or the city government been asked that question yet?
Yes, I asked them, and I didn't really get a direct response. You know, when you ask somebody something like, what's 2 + 2? And you get an answer saying, well, you know, back in the day. Basically, it is essentially a policy shift by CATS. They said that armed security guards are just one.
Hold on. Were city leaders aware of this before the report came out?
Probably not. No, of course not.
To some extent, though, because there was a lot of reporting post-COVID about the lack of security and presence that was there. And they publicized a lot, actually, that they were doubling the amount of security funds.
So,
did they talk as much about the guns? Probably not.
Was this reduction enforced by the security company that we hire out, we outboard hire, or the decisions to which company we hire? Was that done under Brett Cagle's leadership? He's the interim CATS CEO, or the previous occupant of that position?
2022 would be both. I mean, this most recent contract was Cagle, but Katz is going to say, and the Katz has said, and when they respond to me, that there isn't a reduction in force. There's a reduction in armed force. There is an increase in unarmed security officers.
Okay. The state auditor's report also drew attention of the North Carolina House Speaker, Destin Hall, who said that it revealed, quote, that Charlotte officials put woke DEI ideology ahead of public safety. That has quickly become the go-to boogeyman among MAGA Republicans. But in this case, there is some evidence to that effect. Alex, what did this report find?
The report highlighted that when the city hired the current contractor for security, PSS, that they had specifically targeted companies that were inside an inclusion program, which was targeting women and minority-owned businesses. So the auditor is saying they limited other qualified contractors because they were trying to do some kind of DEI checkbox, as he put it. There's no actual, the city pointed out in their response, there's no actual evidence that PSS is not qualified or if there's any issues with the services they provided. I mean, of course, the auditor is concerned with the ratio of armed to unarmed guards, but whether or not they have been doing a good job is not outlined specifically in the report, besides, of course, the light rail attack where there was no security on the train.
Just because a business is owned and operated by women or owned and operated by another minority doesn't mean they're not qualified, but it's another layer of consideration when you're choosing a company like that. And State Auditor Dave Bullock had a recommendation on how security firms should be chosen.
Government should look to the best qualified firm providing the best value to the citizens to provide the maximum amount of security for the folks that ride. I think the public should take this as an opportunity to hold their elected officials accountable moving forward to provide maximum security on the CAT system.
Well, the election is weeks away, but the candidates have pretty much been chosen by this point. The mayor did respond to this audit. I only have 30 seconds. What did she say?
Her biggest takeaway was like, if there's a problem with PSS, tell us there is, but that's what you're alleging. And, you know, you're not presenting evidence for it. But this is only the preliminary report. A final report will come in the coming weeks, and then we'll have a new response from the mayor and new findings from the auditor.
Has anybody responded to why we're paying substantially more for substantially less? I'll just leave it there. We don't have time for an answer to that. I'll just leave it out there for everybody to think about. When we come back, we go to the governor's office at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Alexandria Sands from Axios Charlotte, David Hodges from WBTV, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and moments from now we'll hear from Julian Berger, our race and equity reporter at WFAE. The governor, Josh Stein, on Tuesday signed a bill permitting a 1-cent sales tax for transit referendum to be put on the ballot next month. He endorsed the plan, saying, quote, "Now's the time to make the critical infrastructure investments to keep Mecklenburg County a great place to live, work, and raise a family." We've been talking about this for years. It all quickly came together this summer. The legislature passed the bill. The governor just signed it. We're good to go. But it's cutting it close. Do supporters have enough time to convince voters to say yes to this, Alex?
I think they do. It's a $3 million campaign.
Hold on for a second. The Charlotte Regional Business Alliance is leading this multi-million dollar campaign in favor of the referendum. Where's that money being spent? I've seen nothing about this. Not word one.
I think one thing is putting out press releases like this where they say the governor has endorsed the transit plan that he already signed legislation for. That's one way that they're probably spending the money is trying to get that publicity.
$3 million for typing up a press release? I want that job.
It's a great question, Mike. We'll investigate.
You know, I have theories. I don't know this for fact. I do think that the campaign's a little more muted than maybe they were expecting it to be because of the tragedy that happened. I have gotten messages that there are apps running on streaming devices. So some TV ads are starting to play now. And I, you know, early voting, in-person voting will start in 2 weeks. You're going to have volunteers at every single precinct, not volunteers, paid people handing out literature, I'm sure, and that's where a lot of the money will go.
The reason this is so curious is that the CEO of the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance that's leading this multimillion dollar campaign, Robert McCutcheon, says that Stein's endorsement reinforces the urgency of this moment. It's essential for the future. And yet, I've seen nothing. In election days, November the 4th, and early voting begins on October the 16th. Okay, another recent shooting in North Carolina getting national attention, David. A veteran, has been charged with killing three and injuring five in a Southport bar shooting incident. He shot them from a boat that he was piloting close to shore. What else do we know about the shooter or the shooting?
The reporting that I've seen on it, done by all of our great colleagues across North Carolina, is that this is a veteran who suffered from PTSD. He had written a self-published book, had started really getting into various conspiracy theories that I think you would relate to QAnon, and eventually took some violent action. This, again, raises a lot of questions about mental health and how that is treated or red flag in the state.
When talking about how he might proceed in this case, the Brunswick County District Attorney John David mentioned the death penalty.
I will say that North Carolina is a state for which the death penalty is a potential, and my office does seek it in appropriate cases.
The death penalty has been kind of on pause in this state for a while, but the newly passed Arenas Law, named for the young woman murdered on the Blue Line, has provisions for expanding the use and the methods used in carrying out the death penalty. You say, David, that critics of the bill believe it will not have the intended result. It won't fix the problems that led to Zaruska's stabbing. Why?
I think it has little to do with whether or not the death penalty is implemented, and a lot more to do with the resources that exist for the mental health competency evaluations and voluntary commitments that they're proposing. For example, I had a source bring up to me that the shooter in the Charlie Kirk situation had received their mental health competency evaluation within days of that shooting. It has taken much longer for DeCarlos Brown Jr., who stabbed Irina Zarutska, to get the same evaluation. In a previous case, he had also been ordered for a competency evaluation that never happened. The resources do not exist in this state to try and increase it the level that they're talking about in Irina's law.
And as we heard when talking about the congressional subcommittee hearing in Charlotte on Monday, Democrats point to mental health treatment as being something that we should focus on. The mayor has spoken about that. And at a press conference following the Southport shooting, Governor Stein also urged that we fix what he calls our broken mental health system.
It has to be our top priority. Recent events here in Southport and Charlotte, not to mention Michigan, Utah, Minnesota, and Kentucky, and I'm talking about just in the last few weeks, are clarion calls telling us that we have more work to do to make sure that people are both actually safe and that they feel safe in their communities. We must fix our broken mental health care system.
And he added that he is willing to work with anyone in the legislature to do so.
We know that the vast majority of folks with mental health challenges pose no risk to others, but some can. There are too many people in our communities with dangerous obsessions exhibiting threatening behavior who do pose risks. We have got to do better. And I will do everything that I can, and I will work with anyone and everyone who is serious about protecting the people of this state.
Is there anyone on the GOP side of the aisle who views this as a fix?
It has to be part of the conclusion. I mean, just as much as you cannot be released, as they're saying, the GOP is saying, you can't be releasing people on cashless bail, written promises to appear if they have a mental health condition. We're releasing them on written promises to appear and waiting months to get mental health competency evaluations. They have to be willing to work together to find any type of solution.
Stein also had some time this week to talk about the legislature and the need to for them to increase Medicaid funding in the state ahead of the October 1st deadline, which has now come and gone. He wanted them to add money to the program.
So give us that money so that we don't have to cut the rates we're paying providers to provide important and oftentimes life-saving health care. They need to set aside their disagreements and focus on the health of the people of North Carolina. They have not done that, and they need to do so immediately.
They didn't. The deadline came and went. Republicans in the General Assembly have yet to iron out their intramural differences on the budget, which impacts Medicaid funding, which is now has a shortfall, I believe, of $319 million. This is really complicated because there is money to fund the program without those additional dollars, but evidently, David, it has to be rationed. Is that what's going on here?
Yes. What the Stein administration has done has cut how much they're willing to spend in the interim because they believe they do not have enough for the entire year. What the government does is essentially says, we need this much money for Medicaid funding up front. And then they do what's called a rebase, where it's like, actually, medical services are costing this much right now. It increased dramatically. The GOP did agree to add some of that funding, and I think both the House and Senate agree on that, but disagree on a completely separate issue, which is why the funding has not been approved at this point. So maybe what Joe and I and Alex were all asking for Democrats and Republicans to get along, is impossible if the House and Senate, both controlled by the GOP in North Carolina, cannot even agree on this.
Okay, so before we run out of time, I have to spend some time here with WFAE's race and equity reporter, Julian Berger, who's been sitting quietly in the wings waiting to come on, and the spotlight is hitting him warmly in the face right now. On Wednesday, Julian, a law went into effect in the state requiring sheriffs to work more closely with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. There have been some stumbling blocks to that cooperation over the years in counties like Mecklenburg, where sheriffs are Democrats. What does this new law require? Unmute yourself, Julian, or somebody needs to help bring up his Vader. Go ahead.
There we go. Do you hear me now?
There you go. Yes.
Perfect.
Go ahead.
So this new law, House Bill 318, it basically expands the list of offenses that trigger cooperation. So it now adds more felony charges, DUIs, and certain sexual assault offenses.
So sheriffs will now have to hold undocumented immigrants for 48 hours past their release date. How does that differ from what was in place before?
Yeah, so the biggest thing is when those 48 hours start. So now, like you said, it's that release date. So 48 hours past the release date, they have to be held. The other new thing is that they also have to notify ICE 2 hours before the inmate is going to be released.
Now, we've heard from other sheriffs, including Gary McFadden, Mecklenburg County Sheriff, that he has done this. He has complied with the previous restrictions and orders and notified ICE that he was about to release people, and they never responded. Will this change that?
We don't know. We don't know if this will change that. I think there is miscommunication between both ICE and McFadden. ICE says McFadden isn't doing his job. McFadden says ICE isn't doing their job.
And you report that there are those who say that this law is unconstitutional. How so?
Yeah, so basically a lot of people are saying this law is unconstitutional because it applies to people who has been accused and not convicted of a crime. And it also forces sheriffs to hold them longer than would otherwise be allowed under the law.
Meanwhile, we know that ICE is set to become the largest law enforcement agency in the country under the Trump administration in terms of the number of personnel deployed. The number of ICE officials is up sharply already since January 20th. How has that played out here?
Yeah, so here we've seen an uptick in the number of people that have been detained and deported by ICE. Data from ICE shows that arrests are up in county jails. So people that undocumented people that are in jails are getting detained and deported by ICE.
And you say that 8 local agencies have partnered with ICE throughout the state, including those in Catawba and Union counties. In what way?
Yeah, so basically, this partnership with ICE called 287G, it works in different ways, but a lot of local departments mostly cooperate with ICE by partnering with ICE to serve immigration warrants inside county jails.
And opponents of what is going on have long said that this kind of regulation makes people less safe because it destroys trust in the community where people are being targeted. They are less likely to approach law enforcement for legitimate reasons because they're afraid they're going to be swept up in some kind of dragnet. Is that proving to be the case here? Are fears rising?
Yes, definitely. We've seen here in Charlotte that a lot of immigrants are less likely to contact CMPD or other local law enforcement because they are scared that they're going to work with ICE and get ICE to detain them and deport them, which is not true here in Charlotte.
Last Friday, just after this program went off the air, the Council on American Islamic Relations announced a settlement with the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office. This followed an incident involving a Muslim woman whose booking photo was being taken. She was booked. What happened during that booking?
Yeah, so she was speaking out at a Charlotte City Council meeting about the Israel and Gaza war in support of Palestinians. She was charged with a noise violation. She was then processed at the jail. And when she was taking her booking photo, she was asked to remove her hijab. She was handcuffed, so the officer removed her hijab for her.
That woman is Layla El Ali, and she described the incident this way.
I was looked at. I was told, your hijab is contraband. You're taking it off. So while I was cuffed, I tried to remove it. The officer finished the job.
So what settlement did they reach?
Yeah, so now the sheriff's office has a new policy, basically allowing religious head coverings in booking photos and throughout the jail. So inmates, when they're in the jail, they can wear head coverings now.
Okay. Thank you, Julian. Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter for WFAE News. Alex, some weird stuff happened this week with airplanes. I think it was Sunday, a maintenance staff at the airport, Charlotte Douglas, discovered the body of a stowaway in the landing gear of an American Airlines flight that recently arrived from Charlotte to Europe. A week has gone by. What do we know about this?
We don't know very much. Getting the typical responses of it's under investigation. We just know that the plane had come from Europe. I think at one point it may have been in El Salvador, but we're still not sure who the person was, how they got on the plane, or when exactly, where exactly they came from. But we may find out more as they continue the investigation.
And one person was hurt after a Delta flight from Charlotte collided with another airplane on the tarmac at LaGuardia Airport a couple of days ago on Wednesday night. What happened there and who was injured and how badly?
Yeah, it was on the ground. It was one plane was preparing to depart and their wing hit the cockpit window of another plane that was on the ground. So it was a flight attendant. They were taken to the hospital with a minor knee injury and they're expected to be okay. And the rest of the people were not hurt. There were 60 other people on the plane that came from Charlotte. And then there were 32 people on the other plane.
Jane Goodall, the pioneering British primatologist, ethologist, and conservationist, died on Wednesday. She was on a speaking tour in California at the time, something she did quite frequently and which brought her to Charlotte and to this program in 2002. Her work in the jungle uncovered a lot of secrets. Before she documented it, it was believed that only humans used tools, but she discovered that chimpanzees did too. And that fueled a passion for bridging the human-animal divide that she pursued the rest of her life. She came to understand those animals, chimpanzees, and even speak to them. So I asked her to speak chimpanzee when she joined us years ago at Discovery Place.
Well, the distance call, you know, if I'm greeting everyone listening, I mean, you are far away, and so I would...
Now, What does that mean?
That's really, I'm here, I'm me, who's out there? Good morning.
We'll have to take her word for it. Jane Goodall passed away this week. She was 91. And we don't have time to talk about this, David, but I know that Madison Cawthorn is running for Congress again, this time in Florida. Is he likely to win? It's a Republican state.
He might actually be outflanked by someone more conservative than him in that district. We'll see.
David Hodges with WBTV News, Joe Bruno with WSOC-TV News, Alexandria Sands from Axia Charlotte, and Julian Berger from WFAE. Thank you for a lively hour. We appreciate it.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.